Hi, this is Jordan Fields in the studios at Rhino Entertainment with the Rhino cast. And I am here. In the not-too-distant future, we'll be talking to... that sort of pegged me as a mystery science geek, didn't it? I am here with Jim Mallon, who is... What are you, the president, CEO? What's your title there?
I have been the president of Best Brains, Inc.
Best Brains, Inc.
Production company that created and made all 170-some episodes of Mystery Science Theater. I also was the voice of Gypsy and the puppeteer of Gypsy for 8 of the 10 years.
Prove that.
Oh, that's a surprise. Well, she's not here right now, but maybe she'll come later.
Oh, that's a cop-out.
It is. Actually, one of the funnest things I ever did, we did a PR tour one time, and we were interviewed by a station here in L.A., and they let Gypsy do the traffic report, and she said, "Oh, there's a crash over on Ventura, and if you want to go see that." And that was pretty fun. So there she is. She showed up.
I got it. All right.
And I'm glad she came out. I didn't know if she would come out, but she did.
Hi, Gypsy. Can I talk to Jim again? Hello? If you don't mind, take me through the formation of... Actually, before we even get to the beginning of the show,
yes.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and you know, your own history, your path to mystery science.
The prehistory of mystery science and what I was doing prior to that stuff?
Why don't you start at your days at Madison?
Okay. Well, that's why I went to school starting in 1974. I explored a lot of different directions and ended up in communication arts, which I considered the sewer of all majors. It's sort of where you drop down to if you're not going to major in anything else. While I was there... I started doing street theater with this guy named Leon Varjan, who was like this brilliant, crazy man. And we would go out on the mall at the campus and do little performances every day for a couple hours. And one day the brochures came out, or the notices, that the positions for student body president and vice president were opening. So we put together the Pail and Shovel Party and decided to run a campaign to get that job. And all we did was make fun of the competition and make light of the entire student government activity. But we ran such an effective campaign that we won in a landslide. And I became the student body president in Madison for the I think I'm still the only two-term president that ever ran that student body. So, and we were probably best known for bringing the Statue of Liberty to campus. We built a larger-than-life replica from the nose up and put it on Lake Mendota in the middle of the, which the campus wraps around, in the middle of a snowstorm in January. So the citizens awoke to the Statue of Liberty poking through the ice, and Northwest Airlines changed their flight pattern so that the passengers on their planes could see the Statue of Liberty as they were landing in Madison. So something I'm pretty fond of. After that,
sounds like you and Mockery go way back.
Yeah, I guess I have a history in that. I graduated from Madison in, I think it was about 79, and got together with a high school friend, and we formed a production company, and we made a horror movie called Bloodhook, about a deranged, musky fisherman in northern Wisconsin who was using tourists to grind up for special bait that the muskies seemed to love. So we made that film on a shoestring, and it was a huge adventure, and ended up ultimately selling it to Troma out of New York, which is a schlock film distribution company, and is in your finer video stores today if you go look for it. And from there, I ended up eventually getting a job at KTMA-TV, which was a little, tiny little UHF station in Minneapolis. And my plan was, back then, we didn't have your iPods and your computers and your digital video cameras. And the only way you can make television is to either have a lot of money or get to a station. And that was my plan. And I hired Kevin Murphy, who became Tom Servo, as my chief of photography. I don't think he ever shot a video camera before in his life, but fortunately for the low-rent liquor stores and furniture stores that were the sponsors on KTMA, that didn't really matter.
So how did you meet Kevin?
Kevin actually was, I think it was a grip and then key grip on Bloodhook. But also, he and I had jobs at WHA-TV, which is the public broadcasting station in Madison. It was a pretty large place, and we worked in different departments. But I think that's probably where I first ran into him.
Mm-hmm. So he was working at KTMA with you.
As the chief photographer.
Chief
and
photographer.
And we ended up making, the low-rent commercials. And then on the weekends and the evenings, he and I worked on different television comedy projects.
Okay. Cut to you...
Burning out.
Are burned out. This is what...
The story... This is the true story. I was at a wedding in Seattle, and I was kind of burned out because we were doing our full-time jobs, and we were doing this comedy stuff, and it just wasn't really getting anywhere. And I talked to people up there because there was a lot of local TV production being done and working with, at that time, was the sort of the rise of stand-up comedy, where I came out of Vegas and came out of Los Angeles, and clubs sprouted up all across America. And the people in Seattle from King TV, who happened to be at this wedding, were telling me, go find the local comedians, because they're all dying to get on television, because stand-up comedy is many things, but it pays horribly. Yeah. And so they are all trying to leap over to television where they perceive money to be. So the only person I knew in the local comedy scene was this guy, Joel Hodgson. And the reason was where I edited the movie Bloodhook was right next door to his space. And so one day I'm out by the elevators, and this guy walks over, and he's got a boutonniere on, and all of a sudden a six-foot flame comes flying out of this boutonniere. And that was my introduction to Joel Hodgson. So I got to know him, and so when I got to KTMA and I was burned out, and someone suggested go to the local comedy community, that's when I gave Joel a call, and we met at a place, as Kevin said later, that was fondly known for its sulfuric potato salad.
You were in my mother's kitchen?
A lot of mother's kitchens.
Yeah.
And I just threw out the idea, look, we've got this studio, we've got a little bit of money. If you got any ideas for a TV show, I'm here to listen. And then about a week later, he came in and he had two legal sheets of paper, and he had drawn kind of a stick figure of himself and two stick figure robots next to him. And he said, we should do this hosted movie, but we should leave the host in the movie. And that was the start of Mystery Science. So I figured, I don't know, it sounded kind of nuts to me, but it sounded interesting. And KTMA, because it was such a tiny little out-of-the-way station, had and no budget, had a terrible film library. So it seemed like a nice match. And
when you say terrible library, you mean it didn't have many films, or it had a lot of films that were bad?
Both. It didn't have many films,
and they were bad.
It had were really bad. Probably, the cheapest packages that station could buy. Ironically, it turned out for us that was gold.
Yeah.
It was, some of the worst movies ever made, and we grabbed them. So we had a budget. The show budget was, I think, $75, might have been $50. Joel got $25, and Trace and Josh, who was the original Tom Servo, each got like $10. And we had a block of about 3.5 hours to do the show complete, because then the wrestlers came in at the next block, and so we had to get it done before the wrestlers were done. It was interesting because the studio was tiny and was right next to a metal fabricating place. So if you listen to the original episodes, you can hear the sound of metal saws tearing through sheets of steel as they form their products. And so there wasn't any time to write the show. There wasn't any time to do multiple takes. Those were straightforward, improv episodes, and they kind of showed that. But it was enough, and after we had done 22 of those, and once again we were facing burnout, there was enough material that we could cut together the best 7 minutes of it, and we did that and got it to Joel's manager, guy named David Campbell, who got it to Rick Leed, an agent. And it was just coincidental, or the planets were lined up just right. HBO was just looking for material programs to start its first 24-hour all-comedy network. And we happened to be there on the doorstep.
Now, was that your intent? I mean, in the course of that first season, the KTMA season, was that always your kind of? Were you always having an eye? Did you always have an eye on taking it to the next level, or what was your thinking in, when you started out? This is going to we're going to go network with this, or this is just fun for now? Or at what point did you say, "Hey, this could be something else"?
That's a really excellent question. I think in the back of everybody's mind, there was always this thought that maybe this could go somewhere. We didn't really know how the show was working for people for a long time. We would make the show, and then they picked the slot opposite 60 Minutes. I think it was like 6 p.m. on Sundays, where people watching that station were pretty low. I think there were a person or maybe two that were watching. And then the show would air, and then Monday would come, and there'd be nothing in the media, and there'd be no phone calls, and there'd be, you know, well, we did it. It was out there, and then we'd do another one. But then I got the bright idea to put up an answering machine, and we put the number up in the show. And that's when we first got a sense that this show was really striking a chord, and because that tape would get filled within an hour after the show was broadcast. And it was people that were enthusiastic, but on the level of enthusiasm that said to us, well, something's going on here. And that really gave us a boost. And because we just didn't know. It was fun to us, but we had no idea how much people were really liking it.
You actually started, you know, most people, in most shows, when they're successful, a fan club sort of emerges. You guys actually beat them to it, didn't you?
Yeah, right away, once that phone thing worked, we sort of got onto that, and we thought, well, let's get a fan club going. We started the Binding Palomar, which was the name of the newsletter, and it just had completely silly and stupid articles in there, and then we got a nice Minneapolis Tribune writer was a fan, turned out to be a huge fan over time. And he did a full-page spread. They sent the reporters out and a photographer out and did a really nice piece. So we were really doing well locally. I mean, this station had nothing going for it.
Right.
And all of a sudden, this one little show that we put together was getting, you know, full-page attention by the local media. And that gave us a boost. But by the end of doing 22 of these episodes, we were once again fatigued and burned out. Joel, in fact, had been contacted by Louis Anderson and was sort of on his way, sort of spending part of his time out in Los Angeles working on some projects with Louis Anderson. And I had a pretty strong sense was ready to, you know, move on to something else. And I didn't blame him. I mean, it was exhausting doing this show, and it really didn't seem to be going anywhere. And that's when we decided to put together the best of 7-minute reel, and there was quite possibly 7 minutes of best of material. And that's what was brought to ultimately to HBO's first incarnation of what ultimately became Comedy Central, something called the Comedy Channel.
So you found yourselves at the Comedy Channel for the first season. I think during the second season they merged with their rival network, Ha,
right,
and became Comedy Central.
No, first they became CTV, and then they were sued by the Canadian company of the same name.
Oh.
And then they became Comedy Central.
Well, so you find yourselves there. This is a whole new, but you stay in Minneapolis, right? I mean, they're not whisking you out to produce in L.A.
Well, no, they wanted to. The executives at the new formed channel, first of all, they wanted us to all move out to New York to make it, and their studio was inside their corporate office. And it was sort of like the center of the corporate office with the corporate desks all arranged around it, and then with these wall panels that would open. And then the ceiling was about 8 feet high, which, if you know anything about TV production, is not ideal because of all the heat the lights generate. And so we took one look at that. Aside from the fact that we didn't want to move out there, it was like, this is going to be crazy to try and make this show in here. And so we made that a deal breaker. We said we couldn't do it. So then they said, okay, fine, you can make it. But then they said, we're not going to pay you any money or next to any money to do it. And our really good agent said, okay, don't pay them very much, but they get to own the copyright, and that made all the difference.
I'll bet it. Oh, my God, yeah. And then the being in, you know, doing the show in Minneapolis over the years, you were at Comedy Central for 7 seasons.
Right.
7 seasons on Comedy Central. Being in Minneapolis must have been... away from, in other words, away from the parent looking over your shoulder.
Very much so.
Must have been kind of nice.
It was. We had a couple things going for us. Obviously, the physical difference and then the cold. There were great sections of the years that those executives dare not come to Minneapolis because it was so freezing. And that actually, I mean, one of the things that was really cool, it was sort of a historic thing. When that network started, they were so busy trying to figure out how to fill 24 hours a day with comedy. They really couldn't do the kind of supervision that happens today with shows, where usually an executive is assigned and an executive lives on the set and the executive gives notes. We sort of scooted under that radar, and then because of the fan support, which was fantastic right from the get-go when we started on the network, and because of we had really good media reviews, that kind of insulated us. And then, of course, they... really had to make an effort to come see us, and they mostly didn't, and that was fine by us.
And in all other respects, how, you know, to what extent were they involved in the creative process? Did they give you notes? You know, were they constantly asking you for revisions? Or did they pretty much leave you alone?
They pretty much left us alone, which was just fantastic. Part of it was we had done 22 episodes. We had figured out we had a pretty good idea of the chemistry of the show and how it worked. So we knew what was a deal breaker and what wasn't a deal breaker. Part of it was it worked. And I think those executives were so busy doing other things, they didn't need to tweak this one. This one was doing fine. And part of it was a gift from the gods, I think.
What is it about? Taking a break from the chronology of the show, what is it about bad movies that people love to watch them? Why do people enjoy watching bad movies?
Boy, that's an excellent question. I think there's sort of there's a tipping point when you're watching a movie. Yeah, I think everyone, by and large, gives the movie a benefit of the doubt. They're going to commit to the time to watch it. They want it to be a good experience. If a movie is sort of good, you kind of walk away going, oh, ho-hum, this wasn't really the best use of my time. But when you get a bad movie where it goes beyond the tipping point, where it's so bad it actually becomes its own entertainment again, then I think it's interesting. And then exactly what we did is all we did, I think, it was confirm the sort of thoughts that people have when they're watching a bad movie. This is outrageous. How can they be saying this? And then going further, throwing out comments to the screen and so on. And I think we were just fortunate to capitalize on that phenomenon.
Had that ever been done before, to your knowledge?
There were some precursors. I'm thinking of, like, What's Up, Tiger Lily, maybe?
Well, he redubbed. He took a Japanese film and he dubbed his own script. I mean, he recorded a new soundtrack and not quite the same. He didn't let that movie play out like you guys did.
I don't think what we did exactly had ever been done before. Joel would reference a Disney movie where you could see characters in silhouette in the front of a theater or something.
Bugs Bunny, I think, does that too.
Right. So there may be some things, but I think Joel was very original with that concept.
And who were the other players? Tell me a little bit about the other players on the team.
Well, originally it was Joel Hodgson, of course, as Joel, and then it's a funny story. We needed people to run these puppets that he had invented, so he called up two guys he knew from the stand-up community. One was Trace Ballou, and the other one was Josh Weinstein, and they had no idea what they were doing when they walked in that studio, and they hadn't been assigned puppets or anything. And Trace walked over and saw this crow. It was a sort of rudimentary crow, and picked him up and, in a sense, breathed life into that robot. But they had no idea that day what was going on. Joel just said, "Yeah, why don't you come down and help us out?"
So there were never any established characters that they had to then fill or to voice.
No, in a way, those guys developed the personalities. Yeah. And then Kevin Murphy, who was our chief of photography or whatever ridiculous title we gave him at that station, was Cambot originally, and then after the first season, became Tom Servo.
And when did Mike Nelson join the crew?
Mike was one of the original writers that we hired for the first season.
For the first Comedy Central season. Comedy Channel season.
Right. We rescued him from Friday's Restaurant. And that was a public service that is not very well credited. He was one of those guys that wore all those buttons. I don't know if you've ever been on Fridays.
Yes.
They're into buttons for some reason. It's part of the culture there. And so he had a whole chest full of buttons and stepped off there. Actually, he was a pretty well-known stand-up comedian in Minneapolis area, and that's how he got the job.
I bet he was a pretty fun waiter.
I don't know. I'm sure it would have been interesting to get a meal served by Mike.
So, like I said, you know, the Comedy Central years, I mean, you were on season after season, and that is pretty unusual. You know, even back then, well, not that long ago, but even back then, it was pretty unusual for a show to last that long.
Yeah, although, you know, at the time, it was pretty nerve-wracking. We originally got a 13-show commitment. And then the phrase was 13 and then, what was it, back nine, I think.
Back nine, yeah.
And we didn't get a back nine. We got the first 13 and then they waited until season two. I might have that wrong. I'd have to look into that. I don't think we got the back nine off the first season. And so we had this period of time, it was like 4.5 months, where we didn't know if we were alive or not. And that's where fans became active in helping us get the network's attention. What we ended up doing that four-month period is play laser tag in this sort of weird warehouse complex that we found ourselves in.
What was that called? Eden Prairie?
Eden Prairie is a suburb of Minneapolis, largely a land filled with industrial warehouses and light businesses and stuff. And Trace's brother had a huge corporation. And they had a division that they were pulling back, and they had all these empty buildings, and he let us go in there. That's where we did it. In fact, we were there for all 10 years.
Wow. And throughout the course of the seasons, you know, the show it really reinvented itself several times, not just cast and crew, but also concept. I mean, not the essential concept of doing these commentaries over battle movies, but the wraparound concept around the reason that these movies were being mocked. That must have been a tremendous growing process and maybe even painful at times.
Well, the thing about the series is it changed constantly from the very beginning, from that little TV station. I mean, one of the major changes that happened once we were on our own and making it for the networks is that we had the budget to write the show instead of improv the show. So quality-wise, it went way up because we basically improv the jokes while we're watching the movies in the writing room, and then there's an opportunity to go back and enhance those and add more and so on. So there was a huge change there. The original budget was so tiny. The original set is pretty bad. And then that evolved as we sort of got more money over time. We were able to figure that out. The care and feeding of the robots improved over time. We actually had art department staff to take care of them and put on fresh coats of paint and make sure that they looked good on camera. We also went from sort of a meat and potatoes production company helping us shoot it to eventually we ended up with probably the top cinematographer in Minneapolis, a guy named Jeff Stonehouse, who's a brilliant guy, does work all over the world, and he is, you know, his efforts were to try to make the show look as good as possible. And then we had the creative changes. Joel left after 5 years. We shifted to Mike, and then Trace left, and Frank left, and so we had to constantly evolve the characters of this and the storyline of the show. So from start to finish, there has been, it was always about change. However, if you talk to a lot of the fans, they take umbrage with change.
Yeah, I know.
Change
I was going
was part of the deal from the get go.
That was my next. I was gonna start with that one next. I was gonna say that I can't think personally of another show. You know, everybody kind of knows the story of how Family Guy got back. The Family Guy got back on the air. There was an enormous campaign.
How did that happen?
Well, there was an enormous campaign by the fans.
What happened?
Actually, it wasn't a campaign.
In episode 7.
It was the. Oh,
I'm just
see,
giving you some. This is a, I'll be good.
You fans are your friends.
You don't have to tell me. I know.
Family Guy. Well, it was the DVD. The DVD did so well that the network said, "Oh my God, I should probably put this back on the air." So they did. But your fans, the fans of Mystery Science, throughout its life, have been unusually influential. I would think, influential in terms of. Making the networks listen to them, making Comedy Central listen to them, then Sci-Fi listen to them.
Yeah,
I won't even get to their reaction to the changes in the show, but they have been another crew member in a sense, another player on this team.
The 12th player.
The 12th player. Yeah.
What sport would that be? That's football, right?
It's Comedy Central. It's Mystery Science Ball.
You know, and it's a good question why our show had such great fan response. And I think part of it is it was a very personal show. It was a show you could look at and see how it was made. It was a show that I think, like I said before, struck a chord with people and how they experience television and movie watching. I think also is a show that appealed to, I used to say, B-plus students and above. I mean, it was a very much liberal arts show. A lot of our references are the things you learn in history in college that you really don't use very often beyond college, but you, as a good, broad liberal arts education,
right,
is what you get.
You're rewarded for having that, yeah.
There are also people that are technically very savvy, and Mystery Science rose at the same time that the World Wide Web really took off. And so there was natural gravitation for the fans to organize themselves through the tool of the internet. And entertainment people are entertainment networks are largely lag way behind technical development, which is a subject of a different podcast you should have today. So they were always so shocked and surprised by the kind of organization and the focus and the energy that our fans had. And there are also people that were really, I mean, I think Mystery Science, pound for pound, is as funny as television could get. And so you get people that are totally jazzed by that, that are technically savvy and intelligent and know how to get things accomplished. And that's a pretty awesome army to have at your disposal. So at many turns, from season renewals to getting Mystery Science the movie going, the fans played a pivotal role in terms of having the network feel their presence and feel their needs and feel their desires.
And, of course, back to what you were saying earlier, there is this other element when it comes to having a large fan base, which is they're extremely loyal to what they love. And when Joel left the show in the middle of the fifth season,
right,
there was something on the order, you know, in the pop culture world, there was this schism that I don't even think, the people who created Star Trek The Next Generation got. The Joel Mike Wars. And in fact, I think there's even, the Flame Wars of 93, right, on the internet, the camps just doing battle.
Well, that's part of the fun of the whole thing. I mean, it's all pretty nuts when you think about it. It's just a Cowtown puppet show. It's a tribute, really, to people do take this stuff really seriously and very, very personally. And so there were those immediately that just could not envision it without Joel at the helm. I mean, Joel had a tremendous stage persona, and it was kind of a droopy hangdog sort of low-key approach that just really did it for a lot of people. And Mike had a different style, completely. So...
To what extent were you guys, though, aware of this schism in your fan base, and what did you think of it?
Well, we were, I mean, overall, I know how I felt, which was I felt like it didn't feel right to end the series. It felt like this was a great series. This is really fun to do. Let's keep going. So I was, you know, hopeful that the transition would be as painless as possible. I certainly knew that it was going to be very, very difficult because Joel had his stalwart fans, and there was no question about that. But Mike was a head writer. He had done countless bit parts in different sketches. He was not unknown to the fan base, and he's a heck of a performer. So I felt pretty good that that was a good choice. But, yeah, we were aware that it was hard for a lot of people, maybe a little harder than it should have been. But nonetheless, that's how they treated it.
But, you know, hate it. You know, I mean, their passion just meant they loved it. I mean, even if they were angry, love was at the center of that.
Exactly. I mean, if you don't care for something at all, you're going to act differently than if you really do care for something. So, yeah, you know, and then we had great moments over the years where we did have the conventions where we got the fans together.
Right.
And it was phenomenal energy. As you imagine, the people that... And a lot of them didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, to travel to Minneapolis and spend, I think, 3 or 4 days. So some of the most fun parts of that were we had studio tours. And so we had a school bus that would bring them from the hotel out to the suburb. And the drivers got kind of cynical because of the level of enthusiasm. So one of the drivers, when they'd open the door, would announce to the bus, "Mecca." And honest to God, it was amazing to watch when the tours went through. It was just, you know, it's a typical industrial building there all over America. Everybody knows what those look like. But then you opened one door, and inside, set up permanently, were the two main sets, the Satellite of Love and the Mad Scientist Lair. And the people would, like, not want be able to take a step in the room when they saw it. It would take their breath away. I mean, these were people that were just... This was a very special place for them, and boy, the respect that they treated it was awesome, and it was awesome. You know, it was very humbling to be at the center of that level of passion. I mean, I was always humbled by it.
You had some celebrities appear at these conventions. What people from the films that you know that you watch?
A few of them, yeah.
Russell Johnson was at one, I think, and
right.
You had Beverly Garland at one. There's a...
And they received standing ovations, and they were so into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what was cool. It was a really fun phenomenon. And then to have the people that we were actually making fun of be there and be big enough to be able to go, this is cool.
Speaking of which, you have a story about Kim Cattrall.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting. This is before her... Well, no, probably no, concurrent with her rise... In Sex and the City.
Well, she appeared in the movie City Limits.
Yeah, one of the ones we made fun of. Yeah,
right, it was a 1985 movie.
Contract actor for Universal, and so got into that movie. And the funny story there is about a month before we produced that episode, we were out at the ACE Awards losing again because we never, ever were able to capture a coveted ACE Award. But Kim was one of the presenters, and she wore a very fetching... red dress that we all remembered vividly. And then when we went into the writing room and she happened to be in this movie, it was decided that there should be a song written to Kim and sung by Crow, his ode to his love to Kim Cattrall. So we put that in the show, and then what we found out is Kim was in New York working and was in her hotel room and was flipping channels and happened to catch the episode and see this little gold robot singing a love song to her. So it was a strange moment for her. She screamed and had her boyfriend come rushing into the room. They couldn't believe what was going on. And she ended up sending a bouquet of beautiful roses to Crow and a note. And so the next time we were in Los Angeles, we were able to have dinner with her. That was kind of a fun moment.
That's pretty cool. In the seventh season, I'm sorry, in the eighth season, you moved over to the Sci-Fi Network.
Right.
What was the difference in your experience working between Sci-Fi and Comedy Central? Was it a sea change?
Different situation. First of all, we had a reputation, so we kind of came in at a different level than starting at the bottom with Comedy Central. Also, sci-fi had a sort of a network mandate. They needed sci-fi-based movies that we made fun of. So we had to shift away from beach movies or just silly movies and really find sci-fi movies to make fun of, which was appropriate, but that was a change for us. There was a little bit more money involved, so that was nice. It allowed us to relax a little bit. And, excuse me, let me think. What else was different about that?
Production-wise, I mean, you're working in...
Sci-fi didn't have as cool an office. I remember that. But that wasn't real important.
Seems like they should have a really cool office. Sci-fi?
You would think. A sci-fi office.
For fans who want to know more about the show, there's a truly impressive website devoted to all things Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's mst3k.com, and it's maybe one of the most comprehensive and kind of passionate websites about a beloved TV show that I've ever seen.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
A lot of people have asked questions, and there are always, you know, rumors and bets going on these kinds of sites. One question I know that they have is, was the show ever called Mystery Science Theater 2000?
The answer to that is no. The story of the name of the show was we were in the hallways of KTMA about a week away from the show debuting, and the programming director said, we need a name. And I said, hey, Joel, we're going to need a name. And he said, Mystery Science Theater 2000. And I thought, well, we're awfully close to the year 2000. Can we bump that up a little bit? So then we said 3000, and that's how it got its name.
So it refers to a year,
well,
the 3000.
You know, it's hard to pull apart these artistic things, especially with the amount of thought and effort that went into that.
The minute you try to deconstruct it, the magic goes away, doesn't it?
There's something about 3000 that suggests a different future than 2000 does.
Right. That's so true.
As we talk here.
Although the line is the not too distant future.
Oh, well.
See, that would be 2000.
See, I think you needed to come to the convention and see. Oh, never mind.
I wanted to ask, do you have a favorite episode of the show?
Three of them come to mind. Of course, Manos is beloved by most as perhaps the best worst movie ever made that we did. Mitchell is a solid episode. My favorite part there is the first time we see the star, Joe Don Baker. He's slouched asleep in the back of a squad car, and I think Crow says, ladies and gentlemen, the hero of our story. And then the other, what's the other one that I was thinking of? Moon Zero. Let me think.
Red Zone Cuba?
Well, that's pretty good, too. That's just a disturbing little thing. You really have to check your sanity after you watch that to think that people actually made that thing. I don't know. There's so many. The one where they go to the moon, though, I think that's Destination Moon? Oh.
Destination Moon. Well, I can't think of it offhand.
I don't know. I used to know all these.
Yeah.
Not any longer.
We'll have to ask the fans.
The first show of the second season. There we go. You can pause the tape.
Was that Rocket Ship
XM?
M?
That sounds right. Very good. Well, you know all this.
Oh.
Let's start that one again. You know, one of my favorite shows was Rocket Ship XM. Noah Beery, I believe.
Noah Beery.
The
James Rockford. Jimmy
James Rockford's dad.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I like that one.
Another aspect to the story of the creation of this show, and even more pertinent to where I work, is the clearance of these movies. I know it sounds like a boring subject, but the truth is, I can't imagine a greater detective conundrum than clearing these old movies. Now, they play a huge part in how Rhino releases them, because it's very tough to track down the rights holders to these movies. Many of them have passed from hand generation to generation and hand to hand, and You know, I might even own one without knowing it for some reason. But, you know, how did you guys do this over the years?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And the answer is we didn't. We never, ever tracked down rights. We always had the network do that. I mean, as you know, you basically need a small battalion of lawyers to track this stuff down. And what happened was those networks were approached by distributors of all walks of life. And then I think they approached a fair amount themselves. And we would be sent what were called screeners, which were essentially VHS copies of these potential movies. But we had a 20-to-1 ratio of watching screeners to the ones that we ended up picking. It took a tremendous amount of work to find films that worked for Mystery Science.
And that was that applied throughout the course of the show's history? I mean, even in the very last season, people were sending you these screeners and...
Yeah, it was kind of a fun task to crack open a fresh box of screeners and pop them into the machine. Usually you could tell within the first 4 minutes whether it was going to work or not. And then someone had the task of, we made it a law that someone had to watch it all the way through because you didn't want to be ambushed by some sort of horrible mutilation or rape later on, which many of these movies had. So once it had cleared that hurdle, then it became a Mystery Science movie.
So season 10 goes by and it ends. Why did it end?
Well, one thing, it was getting harder and harder to find movies. That was one factor. The other was, you know, it was a pretty phenomenally talented group of people who had worked in many cases on this project for 10 years, and that's a lot to ask anyone. And I think everyone there had thoughts about, okay, I've done this. Where do I go next? So
did the cancellation come as something of welcome news there?
I think it was a mixed bag. I mean, one thing is we lived in a bubble world. It was a remarkable ride for those 10 years. We had a clubhouse filled with toys. We had a great group of people. We had our own art department, construction shop, and it was a really insular, fun little group of people to be with. So nobody anxiously gives that up. By the same token, you can't deal with the level of talent that we had and not expect that people would want to see what was the next chapter of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people were bittersweet about it, frankly.
Do you sell merchandise, don't you?
We still do.
How do you get that?
Well, if you go to the website that you referenced,
MST3K.com,
they've got it all there, and you can order it through them.
Uh-huh.
We also do a mailing to people that have filled out and sent in their names and addresses to the show as seen in the lower third of the screen a couple of times each episode.
So do you... what's the future of Mystery Science Theater 3000? Is it
new technologies?
New technologies?
Ringtones. Who knows?
You know, fans always want to know if it's ever going to come back.
The answer to that is who knows? I mean, when you make a television show, you have control over only maybe 30% of what happens and whether you get to your show will see the light of day or not. Planets have to line up and wonderful things, which happen in our case, have to happen. I've given up trying to predict the trajectory of the show. I would have thought after it ended on the networks that it would be it. But it has lived on quite well through Rhino DVDs. It has lived on quite well through the Internet. It's part of popular culture now. You see it referenced by film reviewers all the time.
It was just referenced in the 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Was it really?
Yeah, I think it was there's a poster on the wall.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't hear about that one. Simpsons putting one of their scenes. But I mean, it's sort of a term that's now known. If a film is really bad, you say it's fodder for Mystery Science Theater, and people know what that means. That's such a change from our first couple seasons, where inevitably we would go up to somebody and they'd ask what we were up to, and then you'd have to explain. And it took about a minute and a half to give it a good explanation, and then they would look at you blank-faced and turn and walk away.
I actually read that in the first KTMA season, like even maybe after the first show, phone calls came in to the station. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they came in and people complaining that they couldn't hear the movie because people were talking
that
over
was
it.
One of them, someone thought they're that particular person's set was way out of whack and the silhouette was dropped off the bottom of their screen.
Oh,
so
they thought they were hearing voices
while they were watching the movie. that's pretty funny.
Well. You know, I believe you're right. It's hard enough to have a successful show, and even harder still to create and cement a brand that is known and loved by so many people. And it's truly, you know, like you said, it's pound for pound, one of the funniest shows ever made.
Well, here's one thing to think about, too. I've often wondered about all that. And one thing I have to credit is we were embraced by the sci-fi community. Maybe about the third season, we were invited to one of the cons out in Denver. And I'd never been to one of those things before, one of those big science fiction gatherings. It was kind of a weird coming out party where we were adopted. You know, there's like two dozen things that sci-fi people are really passionate about. And Doctor Who is one of them. Star Trek, obviously, is another one. And when we went to that con, it was like we were now one of the two dozen things that sci-fi people were incredibly passionate about. And that group of people, they're fascinating people. They're highly intelligent, incredibly passionate about the things that they adopt. And so we got a huge lift and a lot of strength and a lot of encouragement and a lot of support over the years from that community.
And no doubt most of them, if not all of them, are the people who are, fortunately for us, buying the Rhino DVDs.
I think that's definitely part of it. And now, actually, they're children. And we're jumping generations, and I know that because my son is in junior high school, and I get a good feedback from him. And that makes sense. I mean, parents will share the stuff that they view fondly from their childhood with their kids. And so it's like the plague. It's multiplying. It's the bird flu of television.
Yeah. Well, Rhino is just, you know, we released a few months ago our Volume 8. And we are scheduled to release our Volume 9 on May 16th. And I'm sure fans are pretty excited about that. And we will keep going and going and going until...
Provided we can get all those labels glued on those discs. And we're working on it right now. As soon as we're done here, we're back in the warehouse getting those ready.
I'd like to thank Jim Mallon for stopping by to talk to us in the Rhino Studios for our podcast. And... we wish you much success in the future, and I think I speak for millions of people. Thank you very much for creating one of the great shows of all time.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today, and it was a heck of a show to be associated with. I couldn't be more proud.